Namaste and blessings. The Swami welcomes you with great love and great respect from the heart of all. Welcome to Meditative Living with Swami Shivananda Giri. Today we continue our series with episode number 16 of the authoritative Guru Gita of His Holiness Mahamandaleshwar Paramahamsa Swarupananda Vishwaguru Maharaj of Los Angeles, California, who is this Swami's guru. And he became the very first white-skinned, American-born human being invited into the rank of the Mahamandaleshwars, who disseminate and defend Sanatana Dharma for this particular planet. So, what we are going to do here is go through the text, and you will get both the text in English and the commentary written by Swami Anantananda Giri on our guru's behalf, as well as this Swami's commentary, if there is anything this Swami feels like going more deeply into or presenting another aspect of or another way of looking at it. Thank you ever so much to Sonic over there in Brighton, England, making all the buttons work and the sounds play and all of that stuff that makes it possible for this Swami to do meditative living. Now, let's begin by discussing what the text Guru Gita is. Guru Gita means Song of the Guru. And this text, well, no one really knows exactly how old it is, but it is ancient. And what is happening in this text is that Lord Shiva is teaching the seven Shakta Rishis, the first students of yoga on this planet. And the way he is teaching them is different than the way he gave to his wife, Parvati. Because Parvati did not need a great deal of what it was he gave to the seven rishis to then flesh out things having to do with yoga. Now also, please keep in mind the term yoga does not mean stretches and twists, that sort of physical stuff. That is an aspect of the overall practice, but a very small aspect of it. That is not the entirety of it. So, when Shiva is giving this instruction, Parvati happens to come by and observes all of this discussion and presentation. And she's curious. She's like, well, I didn't need all that stuff. How come, what's this about? What is it that makes a guru a guru? How does the whole guru concept work? So Shiva stops his teaching of the Shakta Rishis and goes into a direct conversation with Parvati, explaining how the guru principle functions, what it is, and such. So today, we begin with verse 161, in which Shiva says to Parvati, I am unborn and deathless. I am without any beginning or end. I am unchanging, blissful consciousness. I am smaller than the smallest and greater than the greatest. There is none prior to me or after. I am eternal, self-effulgent, and free from disease. I am unmoving and pure. I am the supreme ether or akasha. I am bliss, and I am imperishable. O Parvati, I am not an object that can be apprehended by the senses of sight or hearing. I am nameless and formless. This is how the nature of Brahman is to be understood. Verses 164 through 167, Shiva says to Parvati, just as fragrance is natural in camphor and flowers, just as heat and cold are natural to fire and water, so too is eternity the natural corollary to Brahman. Just as the true nature of earrings and various other sorts of jewelry is nothing other than pure gold, so too am I nothing but the eternal Brahman. Just as the caterpillar emerges as a butterfly, one who meditates on Brahman will become Brahman. By meditating on the Guru, one will become Brahman. He will be liberated from all three bodies, the gross body, the physical body, Pinda, the astral body, Pada, and the causal body, Rupa. Sri Parvati says to Shiva, O Shankara, what are Pinda, Pada, Rupa, and Rupatita? Please explain the meaning of all this. Mahadeva said, Pinda, or flesh, means Kundalini Shakti. Pada, or sound, is Hamsa. And Rupa, or form, means Bindu, or the point. Rupatita, the state beyond form, is completely free of all attributes. The commentary. Pinda literally means flesh. The word is used in reference to the physical body. When Shiva says that this means Kundalini Shakti, he is alluding to the concept that the human body's existence is made manifest by the action of Kundalini, which is a microcosmic offshoot of the macrocosmic Matrika Shakti described earlier. So, although Kundalini is essentially the word, and by word we mean the primal vibratory force of consciousness, also understood as Spanda, or the very first vibration, it is mentioned here to signify the physical body, which is the result of its existing in the dormant state. Pada refers to sound, which Shiva tells us is Hamsa. Hamsa is both a mantra and it alludes to the breath. Since this is the sound that is created when a person breathes. The breath is inextricably bound to the mind and to the life force, or prana, that animates the body. In fact, you could even go so far as to say that Hamsa is prana. The literal meaning of Hamsa mantra is I am. Shiva says that form, or rupa, is Bindu, or the point. But in the strictest sense, this isn't exactly true. Both of these terms used in describing the sequence of metaphysical events that occur in the cycle of creation. Bindu represents the initial manifestation of consciousness in the process of emission. It represents the powers to will and to perceive. Next in this sequence is nada, which corresponds to the word or speech and represents consciousness's power to act. This is followed by form or rupa, which denotes the ability to perceive and to discern individual objects. Thus, when Shiva uses the word form in this context, the word really denotes an entire category of happenings at a relatively transcendent level. He is describing everything from the initial impulse for anything to happen to the capacity for the all-encompassing consciousness to reflect upon itself to the consciousness, to the power of consciousness to act, all the way down to the ability of consciousness to perceive itself as an individual and distinct from other subjects and objects. The Brahman, who is liberated from all three bodies, is beyond the sheath of the physical body. That Brahman is liberated from the sheath of the astral or subtle body, which includes the mind and the prana of the individual, which leave the physical body at death. That Brahman is liberated even from the sheath of the causal body, which consists of Shiva's own powers of will, knowledge, and action. That Brahman is beyond even the most transcendent forms of the deities, who, although existing beyond the veil of Maya, or the illusion of separation, are still defined by identities that are distinct from other subjects and objects within Maya. That Brahman is the Shiva who is beyond all of these. Verse 170. Shiva said to Parvati, "Those who are free from pinda, or flesh, pada, sound, and rupa, form, are indeed liberated and are beyond all forms. There is no doubt about this." The commentary. The guru is rupatita, which is beyond everything phenomenal that can be encountered both in and out of meditation. This is the state of Shiva. It is only in going past all of these things that liberation is found. This is the self-realization that is sought by all seekers. And here, the seeker is reminded not to settle for anything short of the goal by becoming distracted by the extraordinary things that happen along the way. Kindly allow this, Swami, to expand a bit here. In the process, when you are on the path, when you are engaged in sadhana, when you are doing the practices, many, many extraordinary things can take place, both inwardly and outwardly. And it would take far too much time to try to list them all. But please know that anything that can occur, whether inwardly or outwardly, is not the goal. Each of those things, whether inward or outward, whether in the subtle world or the physical world, or any other type of world must be gone beyond. And then, once one is stable beyond all possibilities, then one is liberated. One has seen basically how the magic trick is done. And therefore, you're never, ever duped again to believe in the illusion, although you might become liberated, or a Jivanmukti, one liberated while embodied, who, while still in a physical body, is completely liberated. They know how it works, and there may be abilities available, but all of the abilities thought of as miracles by those who do not understand such things. All of those miracles are very small things and potentials for an individual to get caught up in before actually reaching the goal. Now, as anticlimactic as this may sound, at the highest level, nothing is happening, because that three-way split of seer, means of seeing, and what is seen is not in existence there. It is the stillness, the silence that is infinite and eternal. Anything, once that three-way split takes place, or just the split between subject and object, I and an other, below that, all sorts of things exist and will continue to exist even once you've reached Jivanmukti, but your participation within them is different at that point. Verse 171. Shiva says to Parvati, if one meditates always on the Guru alone, he will become Brahman. Wherever he may be, he will be liberated. Dear one, verse 172, dear one, that Guru who exhibits the wealth of six characteristics, namely, knowledge, self-realization, peacefulness, dispassion, oratory skill, and courage, is God himself or herself. Allow the Swami to interject here. What we are not doing in referring to someone who has attained guru function, we are not blowing them up in that individuated form as God. No, no, no. That's no. They have transcended the individuated state and returned to source consciousness itself, which is undifferentiated. Okay? So anyone who hears the word guru associated with a human being, male, female, regardless the tradition, if you are trying to wrap your mind around that human is God, but you've just swollen that human up as a great big, you've gone the wrong direction. That is a grave misunderstanding. Because the human will still have a personality, which you may like or not like, or that can change, will still have a body that will deteriorate over time and have issues, completely natural, and will also have likes, dislikes, ways of being that you may enjoy or not enjoy. They're still human. But they have reached a point where they have achieved such a knowing that they become tasked through that individuated unit of consciousness, that name, that body, to assist others to reach what they have reached. And that is the function of guru. Guru means the light that removes the darkness, or the knowledge that removes the ignorance. And that's all. That is exactly that big and exactly that limited. We will do the bottom of the hour break song. Sonic, please stick around. And we will be back with 173 on Meditative Living. Namaste and and blessings. Welcome back to Meditative Living with Swami Shivananda Giri as we continue with episode number 16 in the Authoritative Guru Gita series. Verse 173, Shiva says to Parvati, "The Guru is Shiva, the Guru is God, and the Guru is the family of all the embodied. The Guru is one's own innermost soul and is the Jiva, or the individual who issues forth from the soul. There is nothing other than the Guru." Would make this commentary. There appears to be a whole lot other for a very long time, but that is not the case. That is the appearance, and that is the play of consciousness. Verse 174. Shiva says to Parvati, "He who is alone, apathetic, peaceful, free from worries and jealousy, and who is possessed of a childlike nature, is said to be a knower of Brahman." The commentary. Before they are a month old, children don't have the capacity to distinguish any one thing from any other thing. In that sense, they are very pure. Pure though they are, these infants are completely incapable of meeting their own basic needs for survival. They don't worry about this because God, in the infinite wisdom and potency, has made provisions for their well-being. Thus, the parent-child relationship is intrinsic to the human experience. As they get older, the latent mental conditioning of children returns to them from their soul, and they lose that purity. Eventually, over the course of the evolution of the individual soul, when it has accrued sufficient meritorious karma, the individual meets the Guru, who is able to purify the Jiva, or the individual soul, of all erroneous mental conditioning. Being purified, thus, there is nothing obstructing the Jiva's identification with Shiva. This individual is like the child in that unity is perceived underlying all appearances, but unique in that they are simultaneously able to perceive diversity and to function at that level. The individual to whom the pure light of the self is perceived in tandem with its outer appearances is filled with conviction of the supremacy of the big-ass self. While the outer world of manifestation may be regarded as real, it is rightly recognized as a fleeting expression of that, with a capital T. While the experience and subsequent identification with that is at all times perfect, blissful, and permanent. Thus, this is an individual who is marked by supernatural equanimity. He or she does not want anything. They do not worry and do not care what happens. All appearances are only the big S self's perpetual act of becoming. Whatever comes is only the self. It doesn't matter what comes. It comes and it goes, is replaced by something else, and all is good. It is all only the blissful play of consciousness. There is only peace for the one who is able to see in this way. Interestingly, sometimes more so than others, these individuals whose outlook is one of childlike non-discrimination are observably childlike in outer manner as well. This is the author, Swami Anantananda Giri, saying, I once had the honor of having the darshan of one Swami Baba Nataraj Giri. I found his childlike reverie in describing and imitating the fat, tame squirrels that like to visit him at the Shakti Aravan temple, where we both were at the time, quite amusing and endearing. Verse 175, Shiva says to Parvati, there is no happiness in the various Vedas, scriptures, mantras, and yantras. The commentary. The Vedas and other scriptures, all mantras in existence, and their corresponding yantras, which are the rituals, are of value to the seeker only to the extent that they are able to point one toward the experience of the self. That is their intended purpose, but at the same time, all of these can potentially become a pitfall to the seeker if he or she makes the mistake of confusing limited knowledge with transcendent knowledge, or jnana. A person can fill their head with all the philosophy and ritual procedures on God's green earth, but will remain a miserable, ego-bound soul until such time as they have prompted the individual to go beyond these outer signposts and experience the big S self within and for themselves. Verse 176, Shiva says to Parvati, there is no happiness to be found in the path of the Karvaka, the Vaishnava, or by the path of Mimamsa. The happiness found at the feet of Guru alone is compatible with the Vedanta. The commentary. The path of the Karvaka is the path of materialist philosophy. The Vaishnav path is one that presupposes the relationship of devotee and deity. Mimamsa is a theoretical discipline. It is an intellectual approach to the Vedas. All paths ultimately lead to the sacred heart of all. However, it is not by materialism or dualistic worship, or the intellect, that one ultimately finds happiness. It is not until one takes refuge in the all-pervading oneness that is the foundation and fountainhead of reality that happiness is found. The guru is him or herself, this very oneness, and it is only by their grace that the seeker may pierce the veil of duality in order to perceive truth. It is here that one attains the goal to which the Vedas ultimately point. It is here that one finds the wisdom from which the Upanishads drew their inspiration. Verse 177 through 180. Shiva said to Parvati, "The happiness of the sages who live alone and free from attachment is not experienced even by emperors. Not even Lord Indra knows this happiness. Compared with the sages who are ever drunk in the bliss of Brahman and satisfied in the knowledge of God, even Lord Indra is considered lowly. What then can be said of other kings? The seekers after liberation should practice their devotion to the Guru always, because by following that path, they will obtain the supreme liberation. The one who steadfastly practices inquiry into the truth of I am one, alone, without a second, as advised by the Guru, need not take to the course of living in the forest." The commentary. This alludes to the four stages of life promoted by the Brahmanism of the Indian Vedic era. Please refer to verse 41 for a complete description of the four stages of life. The third stage of life is that of the forest-dwelling hermit. It was recommended that after discharging all of one's other duties in life, the individual abandons society to focus exclusively on meditation. This is all well and good if that is the course one chooses to take. However, as this verse points out, it is not really a necessity. Strict adherence to the stages of life outlined by Brahmanism is not the only way, nor is this way complete without guru. With the guru's grace, one may achieve the state of the sannyasin, the abandoner of all worldly concerns, regardless of what the outer circumstances of their life are. Allow this, Swami, to go a bit deeper with this. It's not about gaining superpowers. If you're attracted to those things, you will most certainly go in the wrong direction, because each and every one of them, if the ability is preceded by a thought which leads through the doing of that to influencing someone, impressing someone, having sex with them, getting money from them, then it is entirely selfish. And it is not pure. For the ones who are moving in the right direction, unusual occurrences just come and go, and they're no big deal. They're not sought after, and they're not pushed away either. They become inconsequential. Certainly they occur. Unusual things will happen, okay. But it's not the doing of these things that is the goal. Verse 181, Shiva says to Parvati, by practicing the mode of self-inquiry described above, even for a short time, one may experience samadhi. Sins acquired during past lifetimes will be destroyed at that very moment. The commentary. Samadhi, this word, is essentially the experience at varying degrees of immersion of one's own essential nature. This happens only by grace. The mode of self-inquiry described above is one way for attracting this grace. The amount of time and effort required for one to experience this within and for themselves varies depending upon the individual. When the guru advises one to inquire into the truth that they are one alone, without any second, this effort is charged with the guru's intention for the seeker to experience it, which again constitutes samadhi. While there is no one-size-fits-all prescribed period of time that can be said to reveal this perspective, it does occur in a relatively short period of time compared to the above-mentioned alternative of taking it upon oneself to abandon the world and go live a life of seclusion in the forest instead. The guru path is the quicker, easier way. Sins are actions that produce undesirable karmic consequences. These consequences include, for example, unwanted occurrences in one's life and undesirable afterlife experiences. The most profound karmic influences, however, are those that perpetuate the limiting notion of I as distinct from an other. This is the root cause of all other sins. Karma is essentially just mental conditioning. The effect of such inadvisable actions is that they are etched into one's very psyche. There they lie like seeds suspended in a dormant state until the conditions arise, which are conducive to their sprouting and bearing their appropriate fruit. Thus, the consequences of one's actions manifest as one's inner and outer reality, sometimes quickly, sometimes in lives yet to come. Spiritual practices burn the seeds of this mental conditioning to one extent or another, the guru path being particularly effective. Of course, a burnt seed does not sprout. When the mind is sufficiently purified, one becomes able to peer through the veil of mental conditioning and perceive the self When one perceives the self fully enough, they merge with it. Again, describing samadhi, which manifests to varying degrees. The highest of these is that one actually experiences that at which the guru was pointing when advising the seeker to perform their self-inquiry. The seeker fully perceives and knows that they are one without any second. There is no other, only I, everywhere. This awareness occurs in a flash of insight, and in the light of this highest perspective, all the remaining seeds of mental conditioning are burned away in a moment. Thus, one becomes liberated from the karma by which they were formerly bound to their identity as the limited body-mind complex. In fact, all latent mental conditioning is burned off. Thus, the individual is spared all sorts of untold miseries. However, karma that has already begun to bear fruit, called the prarabdha, must be seen through to its completion. It is like an arrow that has been fired from the bow and is already sailing through the air. The liberated individual no longer has any personal motive that is separate from the will of the divine. Thus, no more karma is generated due to one's own will as the individual. Verse 182-184. Shiva said to Parvati, "How can one invoke him who is unmanifest? How can one dispose of him who is all-pervading? How can one worship him who is formless? How can one meditate upon him who is devoid of attributes? It is the Guru who creates as Brahma, assuming the quality of rajas, or action, sustains as Vishnu, assuming the quality of sattva, and destroys as Rudra, assuming the quality of tamas. Oneself, having become Brahman, should perceive everything as the diseaseless, all-pervading supreme, and nothing else." The commentary. Shiva is to be worshipped after having become Shiva. This is the highest way. All other worship is based upon the false distinction between the individual self and deity. This is the pinnacle of all worship and can only be accomplished by serving the earthly representative of Shiva, a personal guru. The personal living guru is the embodiment of all deities and the supreme principle, the guru tattva. By taking up the guru path, one becomes Brahman. One becomes Paramashiva. One becomes the Guru Tattva itself. One perceives everything, including themselves, as only one self, the diseaseless, all-pervading supreme. One's worship becomes perfect when they are able to bask in the reverie of oneself as it truly is, in all of its unencumbered glory. That does it for today. Thank you ever so much for allowing this Swami to be of service. If you wish to contact, go to www.swami.info. That's swami.info. There you will find the email address. You're more than welcome to write with questions, comments, complaints, ideas. And we will look forward to meeting you again next week for Meditative Living. Namaste. Om Namo Narayana.